You know, I was not the model of hemophilia self-care growing up. I hated getting stuck. I would hide bleeds so I wouldn't miss school or social activities, and I got so frustrated when, from a young age, I couldn't do the same thing as the other kids. I wish I could tell you that this led to my being immediately driven to succeed anyway, to developing this underdog, chip on my shoulder, Brady Six-like motivation to prove doubts and doubters wrong, and to show the world just how capable I really was. But that's not who I was as a kid. By the way, as an adult, this is Patrick James Lynch of Bloodstream. Thanks for joining me today. I was more a go-along-to-get-along kind of kid, part of the chronic people-pleasing impulse I still contend with, and it probably helped me avoid getting picked on or bullied during stretches where it easily could have gone that way. It also made me an astute observer of people, trying to understand how the comfortable people did what they did, often in groups, so that I could start to figure out just where I fit into the picture. Because that's all I really wanted growing up, to fit into the picture. I didn't need to be the best or even good. I didn't need to win or come in second or in third even. I remember one swim meet, the kind where the 9-year-old swimmers go over to the people at a folding table who have ribbons to self-report the results of your race. One swim meet like that, the chaperone or whoever's there to greet you at the end of the swim lane said, "Good job, you almost came in fourth." I'm pretty sure there were 6 of us in the race, and though I'm not a mathematician, engineer, or certified public accountant, 5 out of 6 is pretty close to dead last. But since they handed out ribbons for fourth, and I heard fourth in there somewhere, I not so proudly walked over to the table so that I could have a ribbon, like most of the kids. I think about that swim meet a lot, when sitting sullenly in the passenger seat on the drive home after my mom asked how I was doing. I told her I hurt my ankle when doing the flip turn thingy at the end of my first lap. That was a lie. My second of the afternoon. But it also immediately took attention off the poor performance and placed it onto hurting Patrick. Because if I couldn't fit in with the rest of the kids, I at least felt comfortable as the hurting patient, propped up on the couch, fed and entertained, and generally left to be. You know, I didn't start self-infusing until 17. And 17 years later, sometimes it's still tough. Physically, emotionally, psychologically. I do wish that I could say at 34 that I don't deal with some of the same challenges and mental blocks that I did at 17, 7, 25, and 30, but I do. The difference now is that I know it's okay. I don't need an unearned ribbon. I don't need to be coddled for a non-existent bleed just to make my heart feel a little better. I simply need to accept that my challenges are mine to navigate, with plenty of support available to me. And some may shift over time, some may not. And when I zoom out at the gift of life that I've been given, hardships and all, hemophilia and all, baked in, these challenges really ain't all that bad. Did you know, you probably did, but maybe not, I'm not a wizard. Did you know that since 2016, the Bloodstream podcast has been made possible by Takeda? As they pursue a vision of a world free of bleeds, visit bleedingdisorders.com to learn more about Takeda's commitment and the resources Takeda's made available for people affected by hemophilia and von Willebrand disease. For tips on living well, disease management, and so much more, visit bleedingdisorders.com. That's bleedingdisorders.com. And since this is the month of Rare Disease Day, Feb 29, and it's Black History Month, happy Black History Month, reminder that while 95% of rare disease patients don't have a single FDA medication approved, we with hemophilia have numerous options available today, and many more being worked on currently. We are very fortunate, even if it doesn't always feel that way. Speaking of rare diseases and medication availability, joining me for today's interview segment are doctors Amar Zaidi and Michael Callahan from the Comprehensive Sickle Cell Center and Children's Hospital of Michigan. We're going to talk about hemophilia disease state blood brother, sickle cell. After literally decades of waiting, the FDA has approved some therapies to control and manage sickle cell, and patients and families are on the precipice of an entirely new treatment era. Sickle cell is a biopsychosocial disease, as Dr. Zaidi is fond of saying, and he and Dr. Callahan will get into what that means and what can be done about it a little later in the podcast. Natalie will also be joining me for today's Like segment, shout out to segment sponsor Genentech, more about them later, in which we'll break down the recent NHF announcement about a collaborative effort seeking to understand the correlation between mental health outlook and participation in gene therapy. Big stuff. That's coming up in a bit. Also want to shout out some additional episodes of Bloodstream that you may have missed since last month. On Feb 6th, we had a Bloodstream mini featuring Laura Fox, physical therapist from UC Denver. On Feb 10, we released the Bloodstream live episode that we had recorded the Friday before, released as a podcast. We also released the most recent episode of Bloodstream Journeys, featuring three women from around the world sharing how humor has helped them cope, manage, and thrive. And on the 13th, we had a Bloodstream mini for Valentine's Day, featuring comedian Avra Friedman. And coming up on Feb 20, I'll be speaking with actor and comedian Nick Novicki about entertainment, health, and inclusion. And at 3'10", as you can imagine, he has a very personal point of view on those subjects. But that's for later. This is for now. So sit back, or keep walking, or folding laundry, or driving to work, or whatever you are doing, and enjoy this episode of the Bloodstream Podcast. Welcome to the Bloodstream Podcast, our flagship episode for February 2020. I'm your host, Patrick James Lynch.
And I'm Natalie Lynch.
And this is the flagship, Natalie. The flagship episode, a new word that we say in the introduction now.
That's exciting. It sounds like I think of like a brick and mortar store, like opening, like this is our flagship store.
Yeah. That's it. Well, it's funny because like flagship kind of suggests boat with flag on it, but stores are what come to mind for me too, so
right?
I don't know when the transition happened.
The etymology of that, and I also think of Starbucks too. Like, oh, like the flagship Starbucks is in Seattle. Like, you know, most people know that.
That most people do know that about Starbucks in particular. You've been flying a lot recently, and it just dawned on me that I don't know that people know that you fly a lot, or why you fly a lot, I should say.
Well, I outside of being a doula, I'm a flight attendant.
She does it all, folks. Podcaster, doula, flight attendant.
Yeah, and so I was home here in Los Angeles for two births last month, so now I've been on a nonstop flying streak.
How'd those births go?
The births were awesome, and I have another one coming up next month, so that's also exciting because I'll have had more births in by February, as many as I had by April of last year. So, you know, that's exciting.
Absolutely.
But yeah, I've been flying and it's been really funny because so many people on the plane are wearing masks. And in the winter, like the numbers...
Like ski masks or what are you talking about?
Like face masks, like, sickness masks. Yeah.
Right.
And, you know, the numbers of people who get on the plane, like every flight, there'll be like one or two typically.
Sure.
Who just like to protect themselves. And, you know, I don't judge. Maybe they have compromised immune systems. Maybe they just want to stay healthy. And then in the winter, that number normally ticks up to like three or four people. And this past week or this past 2 weeks, it's like a third of the plane have masks on because of coronavirus. And it's just cracking me up because all these people are coming on the plane with masks, but they
from New York to Los Angeles.
From New York to Los Angeles. Or New York to San Francisco, or San Francisco to Fort Lauderdale. Those are the routes I've been doing lately.
Not one province of China to another one.
No. And but because of the like media attention of coronavirus, now a third of my planes are wearing face masks.
In 9 years, have you ever seen something like that?
No, never. It's hilarious.
So wait, are they just like no one's eating or drinking? Everyone's just in their masks for five hours?
No. They like take them off to have like blue chips. I work for JetBlue. It's our signature snack. But blue chips and, you know, their soda. And then they put their mask back on because while you're eating, you couldn't possibly catch the coronavirus.
Everybody knows blue chips reject. Yeah, it's an it's an immediate dissolve.
And then also the weird thing, too, is I get down to baggage claim and these same schmoes who had it on the plane no longer have it on. Like they've taken it off, tossed it in the trash, as though the baggage claim area is a coronavirus-free zone.
With all the same people.
With all the same people who they were like terrified to breathe the same air as on the plane.
What's the plane? I think that's it must be the plane that's infected with the coronavirus.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
So it's just interesting. It had me look some stuff up because I was like, what is this? Should I be worried?
Right, you know, yeah, like after a while,
I'm now seeing
like
every third person get on the plane with a mask, babies wearing them. Like, you know, which to me feels a little dangerous. Like, you know,
anybody's emotional support animal have a mask?
No, but that would be hilarious.
I bet you someone's doing it right now.
For sure. But so far, 490 people have died of coronavirus.
That's not a lot of people.
And most of them in China. And, you know, every life matters. And that is horrible for those who died and those who love those who died. But 490 feels, in the grand scheme of things, quite small. And most of them nowhere near New York, Fort Lauderdale, San Francisco, or Los Angeles. And so then I was like, well, you know, what about the flu? 2017 to 2018, last year, the flu season killed 61,000 people.
Wow.
Here in the United States.
Wow.
61,000 people.
In 1 year?
Yep.
Wow.
810,000 people were hospitalized.
Americans.
For the flu.
Just
Americans.
In the U.S.
In the U.S.
Jeez.
And 45 million people caught it last year and had the illness. So 61,000 people died. And so even last year,
that's intense.
You yeah. know, with these kind of numbers, nope.
How many with the coronavirus have died?
490.
490.
Mostly in China.
And the flu in a year was?
Last year, 61,000. And so this flu season to date, guess how many people have died of the flu here in the United States? 10,000.
Okay, that's, not in 2020, this winter season?
This winter flu season.
That actually feels like we're doing better.
1920.
That seems like we're doing better than 1819.
Yeah, I mean, well, I don't know how long the season.
Well, who cares? The point is the coronavirus.
The point is that already we've lost 10,000 people to the flu.
Yeah.
And then last year, which is how I can compare it, the face mask situation, there were the normal number of people wearing face masks last year. And so far, reported cases of illnesses here in the United States for coronavirus the number's 11.
11 reported cases in the U.S.
Of the illness.
And how many of the flu in a year? It was like 45 million?
So far this year, 19 million. So, anyways.
Well, maybe the masks will help people not get the flu.
Sure. I mean, it won't hurt. But then if you're going to wear the mask, don't eat snacks, don't drink, and leave it on until you get home. Nowhere safe, guys.
The one thing I can understand people listening to this maybe being like, well, actually, about is when it comes to like health and safety and treatment products, we just had a safety summit because of all the product recalls and stuff that happened last year. So it's worth mentioning that earlier this month, the NHF, WFH, and EHC, the European Hemophilia Consortium, put out a joint statement that recognized that the Plasma Protein Therapeutics Association, the PPTA, issued a statement stating, quote, 2019, the 2019 nCoV, the coronavirus, is not a concern for the safety of plasma protein therapies manufactured by the PPTA member companies. The association stated that existing manufacturing methods provide significant safety margins against the coronavirus. So we got nothing to worry about.
I mean, some people have something to worry about, but...
Well, everybody's got something to worry about.
But that's a good statement and good for people to know.
Oh, man. That is pretty hilarious. Is there anything of weird stuff going on this time? Like, I guess the holidays, there's all kinds of weird stuff that happen in the airlines.
I mean,
what about right now?
The holidays, it brings out all the weirdos because, you know, people are very stressed. Like, flying can be stressful for people in general.
Mm-hmm.
And then you add holiday travel, which is... full flights everywhere.
Right.
So that becomes...
And people going to see family.
More stressful. Well, then there's the layer, as though we talked about in the November, December episode, about, you know, just added anxiety of...
Exactly.
What family dynamics cause. So people get on the plane buggered out, and it's a lot to deal with. And I do fancy myself an empath and very susceptible to people's energies. And I really have to... energetically protect myself on the plane during those times. And now I should be actually protecting myself. That's what people
from the coronavirus
are telling me by wearing those masks.
Yeah, you gotta get the masks immediately. I will say one positive plane thing, because I'm usually right there with you on just pointing out and laughing all the weird human behavior that takes place on planes, which, by the way, many of us are guilty of here, so in our own ways. But I was on a flight recently, delayed a little bit. A bunch of people had connections. It was like, I think in Detroit, some middle of the country place with lots of connections. And when we got there, and I've heard this announcement before, it was like, hey, if you don't have a tight connection, if you can please remain seated to let anybody who does have a connection get up and get out of the plane. It's like, yeah, whatever. The whole plane cooperated. Everybody was mad nice.
You were in the Midwest. That's why.
I was on a plane in the Midwest with people going from somewhere else and going somewhere else. Nobody was living in Michigan at the time.
I do have to say, though, there's a better chance there than a lot of other cities or a lot of other regions.
Well, that's fair. A fair number of people are actually landing in Michigan. That's where they live. So they're like, oh, wait, you're right, actually. You're right about that.
I make those announcements all the time, and it really goes to show, because I have the list of connectors, so I know how many people should be getting up, and it's normally like four people who like will miss their Cancun connection and then have to wait a day in a city because it's the only flight. And I watch like 40 people get up, and it's like, come on, just have some common courtesy. Can I do one PSA as a flight attendant here on the Bloodstream podcast?
I would probably benefit from it, so yes.
So I see this more than I don't. People going to the bathroom barefoot or in socks on the airplane. And I cannot tell you how absolutely horrific that is.
Tell us more.
I mean, I don't want to get too gross, but like there's a lot of turbulence. A lot of men have trouble aiming when there is no turbulence and they're on the ground at a normal toilet or urinal. So just imagine the complications that adds to the average man, and that the floors are just littered with urine. Like I wipe them up constantly during the flight, but to walk in there with socks, that's not water from the sink. That is urine all over the floor. And please, please, please never walk into one of those bathrooms in your socks or barefoot.
You heard it here first. The coronavirus, not a problem. Pee on the bathroom floor of the plane, big time problem. Bloodstream, keeping you safe, keeping it honest. So moving into this month's like segment, and before we start the like segment, I want to thank this month's like segment sponsor, Genentech. Now, you probably know the impact of bleeding disorders goes beyond whether your blood will clot or not. There are both social and psychological burdens that affect people living with hemophilia. Recently, Genentech partnered with the University of Pennsylvania's Positive Psychology Center to develop two unique workshops. It says in the copy, Patrick, use a really strange voice. It does. You're just not seeing it. These 90-minute sessions are practical, science-based programs, specifically, but the word written here is specifically, designed to help members of the hemophilia community develop their cognitive and emotional skills to thrive in spite of the challenges associated with bleeding disorders. Your Genentech Hemophilia Community Clinical Educator can help you attend one of these interactive workshops. Clinical educators are a team of individuals with nursing degrees who are dedicated to being an educational and informational resource. I'm never quite sure the difference between educational and informational. I say that all the time too. I write that in copy as well. Educational and informational just seems a little redundant, but also they're not exactly the same. It's kind of annoying.
They're not exactly the same.
But they're not different enough.
But I think the intention with educational is that you should walk away with some information that you learned.
True.
Informational seems like it's an option.
You just show up, someone said something, you're like, okay, bye. Like, I didn't take
like
that
Like my
in.
Bathroom PSA should be educational, not informational.
You can connect with your local clinical educator by calling 1-866-436-5427. Again, 1-866-436-5427, and on to the like segment.
So totally applicable, the Genentech and the ad. Talking about the implications of having hemophilia not being just physical, but the psychological and social components, that very much is tied to our like segment, Patrick.
Yeah, you're right. Right on the money.
So there was an article, actually several articles this week, and the one that I found first was put out by Hemophilia News Today. Core heme results lead to joint effort to create tool for assessing mental health in gene therapy.
Well, that was a mouthful. You're saying there's a lot of articles on this thing?
Multiple sources put out an article announcing this.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So it's an announcement thing.
That this is happening. So this article discusses the publicly available patient-reported outcome measures that are being jointly developed by the Green Park Collaborative and the National Hemophilia Foundation to evaluate the effects of gene therapy on mental health outlook of people with hemophilia type A and B.
Who is Green Park Collaborative, Natalie?
So happy you asked, Patrick. Mm. I'd never heard of them when I started reading this article either. The Green Park Collaborative, or GPC, is a major initiative of the Center of Medical Technology Policy, which is an independent 50C3 nonprofit organization. I can never say 501c3. I always mess it up every single time. I'm talking about entertainment to affect change or literally anything.
Save one life. It doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter. But, you know, people know what I'm talking about. So this organization is dedicated to improving the quality, relevance, and efficiency of clinical research. They work to improve clinical research by cultivating collaboration between drug and device developers, private and public payers, health technology assessors, clinicians, researchers, policy regulators, and the patients that they all serve. A multi-stakeholder forum, GPC develops condition and technology-specific study design recommendations to guide the creation of evidence needed to both inform clinical and payment decisions.
Hoo-wee. It sounds like they're busy over there at the GPC. Sounds like interesting work, complicated and complex. There's a lot of layers to this kind of stuff. How did
great work, right?
What's that?
Great work.
Yeah, necessary. Yeah. So how did the GPC connect with NHF? How did the joint effort start?
This project follows work completed in CoreHeme.
Core what?
CoreHeme. CoreHeme was an NHF-funded initiative launched in 2017. Mm-hmm. It was launched to determine a core set of outcomes to assess efficacy.
Oh, there it is. There's efficacy. Yeah. We knew it was
safety,
coming.
Safety. Uh-huh. Comparative effectiveness.
Comparative effectiveness.
Efficacy and effectiveness in the same sentence.
Yeah.
And value for use in clinical studies of gene therapy and hemophilia.
Ah, okay. What exactly is a core outcome set?
Another great question.
Thank you so much.
A core outcome set is a minimum set of results that should be measured and reported in all clinical trials for a specific condition.
Who are the experts and stakeholders participating in CoreHeme, Natalie? And I'm assuming because this joint partnership between GPC and NHF was born from these results that a mental health outcome was included. Am I correct?
A mental health outcome was included, and the proposed definition included elements of psychological and mental health status, emotional functioning, and positive and negative experiences due to the transformational change of a potentially one-time treatment. Mm. Because gene therapy treatment will serve as a durable therapy for hemophilia, the voters on the CoreHeme Delphi panel stated that it was important to measure the changes in mental and emotional health in relation to this fundamental change in a patient's life.
Mm. Is there an effective or standard way to measure that?
No current measures exist to effectively evaluate this outcome. Based on participant feedback, the charge now is to create a consensus set of suggested measures and instruments to be used for assessment of the recommended core outcomes. And this is exactly what the joint effort between the GPC and NHF is intending to create. The tool that they're creating for mental health will be designed for patients ages 15 and older.
That's great. Gene therapy is trailblazing, and the fact that they are being proactive in creating a tool to assess and capture mental health is a sign that things are headed in a great direction. Mental health historically seems to be the redheaded stepchild. Less resources and time tend to be put towards it. And now we have something where we're getting ahead of a potential mental health shift that would be significant were it not handled so proactively. Thanks, Natalie, for guiding us through this article, and it's going to be exciting to see what comes of this mental health tool, and more interestingly, to see the data that it's intended to capture and what that informs us about over time.
You're welcome, Patrick. I'm also happy to see the attention and resources being given to the mental health effects of gene therapy, as I see it informing whether it might be an effective treatment option for someone who would be considering it, not only to look at the physical benefits, but potentially what the mental health implications of it are as well. So, more to come.
And that is it for the Like segment. We do want to thank Genentech one more time for sponsoring and for partnering with UPenn on those two workshops, as Natalie said, very appropriate given this month's topic. So if you want to talk to your clinical educator for more information, you got to call 1-866-436-5427. One more time, clinical educator, 1-866-436-5427.
Did you know that the XFL is coming back?
I absolutely did. I didn't realize there was like updates about that because I feel like I heard about this months ago, but what's going on?
Okay, so according to NPR today, it was like just nice after the Senate stuff that went on.
Yeah, you're like, wrestlers playing football, that sounds good.
Get into politics on here, but you know, when this comes out, everyone will know what happened.
True.
But yeah, it's LA has a team.
What's our name?
Oh, shoot.
I just got really excited.
I don't know, but the tickets are cheap, cheap, cheap.
Oh, so get in early on the ground floor?
No, I mean,
no.
Vince McMahon would probably like you to, but...
so here's the
thing. I think this is the dumbest investment. He's investing so much money.
I think it's really smart. Vince McMahon's father bought up all of the wrestling operations in Canada and North America to turn something that people made no money on and ravaged their bodies for and drove hundreds into the international multi-billion dollar conglomerate that it is today. Vince McMahon thinks, not unlike our president, he is a reality show producer. He knows what people watch and what they gravitate toward. And the NFL, they have problems with the quality of their game, the integrity of the officiating, the off the field issues with their players. I mean, the concussions, like, they've got so many issues that I think Vince McMahon is not stupid. In fact, the XFL existed before. They know what it feels like, and they're saying, let's do it again.
He sees
something. Look, Vince McMahon and Michael Bloomberg might wind up wasting a lot of money this year, but I think they're both smart.
Okay, well, I love that this conversation will be recorded for history. And I love that when this league fails yet again... we'll be able to play that. I'll be able to play this for you and just say, like,
and I'll be so proud. I'll be so proud. I didn't say the league is going to be a gangbuster success.
I think it's not going to exist. I think it's got one or two seasons max.
That's existing. Also, it may or may not work. It's a good idea. It's a good idea.
Ends don't justify means.
Don't be outcome oriented. The process is smart. Vince McMahon knows what he's doing. I don't like him, by the way.
No,
but I think he knows what he's doing.
But why? How can a good idea be good if it's going to fail?
We don't know that it's going to fail.
I know.
But also, there's
fail.
Plenty of good things that, like, don't work out for one reason or another.
Sure.
Can't believe I'm defending the XFL.
I know. It's hilarious.
I know good
ideas.
I
think it's a giant waste of money.
Well, I'm glad that we have a recordation of the difference of opinion.
Yes.
I'm going to be investing heavily, I meant to tell you, in the XFL.
No, you're not. But I would go to a game with you.
Deal.
Okay.
The Bloodstream Podcast is made possible by our presenting sponsor, Takeda. To learn more about all of the resources that Takeda provides the Bleeding Disorders community, visit bleedingdisorders.com. Again, that is, get a pen ready, bleedingdisorders.com. Joining me now in this lovely hotel room in Detroit, Michigan. Actually, it is lovely. I said that a little sarcastically, but it's true. From the Comprehensive Sickle Cell Center at the Children's Hospital of Michigan, Dr. Amar Zaidi and Dr. Mike Callahan. Hello, gentlemen.
Hey, Patrick.
Thanks
good to be
for
here.
Having us.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. It's actually been a lot of fun. We didn't know each other a few months ago, but I feel like we've bonded very quickly.
Absolutely.
For sure. It's been fun working with you.
Podcasting colleagues in hematology. How did we wind up coming to work together? You guys reached out to me. How'd that happen?
Yeah, Amar said he wanted to start a blog, and I said, maybe let's do a podcast, and neither of us knew anything about it, and I said, you know, I know there's this hemophilia podcast, maybe they can tell us what we need to buy and how you do this, and so we reached out, and it worked out even better.
Yeah, the rest is history.
Cheat Code, the Sickle Cell Podcast was born.
Yeah, it was.
Where was the concept? Well, let's go to, you wanted to do a blog before the podcast idea. What was that intention?
So, you know, my issue has always been that we give patients a really hard time about where they get their information from. You know, patients will come to us with crazy stuff like, I'm treating fevers with amethyst crystals and witch hazel.
Okay.
And historically, doctors are like, man, these patients are nuts, right? Like, how can they listen to this? But sort of internally, I had an epiphany, like, these patients are using the resources that they have available to them. So it's not like they're going to go and search the literature and come up with a conclusion.
They're
and look
deep
at the
dive
data.
In PubMed. And
right,
no,
they're not
exactly.
going to PubMed and Google Scholar. They're going to use the resources that are available to them. And if it's an auntie that's telling them that witch hazel cures fever, that's what they're going to use.
That's the resource.
So it's kind of on me then that I'm not providing them information in a medium that's accessible to them. And it kind of was born out of that spirit. Like, let me remove the barriers to these patients getting knowledge on their disease. And certainly, seeing them in clinic once a year and talking to them about their disease there in a 15-minute visit is not enough for me to teach them about sickle cell disease.
Right.
And it was that spirit that sort of led to all this.
Hmm. Were you an easy in on this, Dr. Mike, or what?
Yeah, I'm being slowly dragged into the 21st century by Amar, but I appreciate it. So, you know, the social media I didn't grow up with, I'm not used to it. I didn't even play video games, so I don't... When he said cheat codes, I didn't know what he was talking about, but I'm enjoying it. I think it's valuable. I think, you know, it's a good way to educate patients, to advocate, to communicate new information. I think it's important.
How'd you guys first meet?
So I was a resident from a visiting hospital. And I came to the Children's
Which shall not be named.
Which shall not be named. a competitor hospital. And I came down to Children's Hospital of Michigan to do an elective in hematology, oncology. And I think that's when I first met Dr. Callahan. And he's like, I'm trying to find the right example, but he's like the golden child, you know? Like, he's like a lifer at our institution, you know? Like, med student, resident, fellow, superstar attending, the golden boy.
Gotcha.
So everybody was like, have you met Mike Callahan? Have you met Mike Callahan? Finally, I did. And then I kind of got it. I was like, wow.
So underwhelming.
This guy is kind of like the golden boy. And the really interesting thing is that the guy who sort of led me to a path of hemonc or hematology oncology was a guy named Charles Main, Chuck Main.
Okay.
Who I interacted with as a resident and a med student, and I found out that Dr. Callahan actually was led down the same path by the same guy.
Huh. Yeah, when I was a med student, I did an elective at the hospital where Amar did his residency with Dr. Main, and he's just a wonderful man. I mean, and just a guy who you can tell is really contented with his life and, you know, giving, pleasant, wonderful to be around, had a great career. And so I think when you see somebody who's doing a job and they just love it that much and they're so good at it, it inspires you to want to do that too. So that was one of my early experiences in Peds Hemonc and really sealed the deal that that's where I wanted to be.
And I think because both of us came with that mentality, like we want to be like this guy, we connected a lot quicker because we were trying to emulate a lot of the same qualities.
It's almost like an assumed shorthand or an assumed vocab before you even really build a relationship with one another just based on that individual.
Right, right. Absolutely.
So did you find that patients were explicitly asking for more resources and different resources? Did that in part lead you to want to create the blog, which became a podcast? Or was it more so just noticing like, oh, it's the information they're getting is coming from the auntie or from that Facebook friend, or it's just coming from too random a place? We have to get involved.
I think more of the latter. So there was more of like misinformation that was just spreading like wildfire. And that really pushed me. But then I started using Twitter to disseminate information that I was getting at really conferences. So I was using it mostly for like ASH. Let me share this with the public. And I had one post that just went bananas. Do you remember that? ASH 2018. There was this one post I had that had like, it went viral, right? And then the patients, I remember the next conference I went to was like a patient conference.
Mm.
And they were like,
they all knew you.
Are you the Twitter guy?
Yeah, of course.
And I was like, maybe? Like, I don't know. Am I? And they were like, yeah, you're the guy that posted about the ER and sickle cell disease. And I was like, oh yeah, that was me. They're like, I mean, and just the way that they embraced me from that one post really opened my eyes.
That says a lot.
Like, this is a group of individuals that will take that information if you give it to them, right? Like they want to be part of that conversation. That really opened my eyes quite a bit. And then I wanted to make it a more regular thing from that point.
So what are some of the most exciting advances that are going on right now in the world of sickle cell that you find it important to be communicating about?
So it's a really exciting time for sickle cell. Sickle cell has unfortunately not had a lot of advances over the last 100 years, but the last 5 years have been pretty different. And, you know, there's been a really hardcore group of basic scientists and clinical scientists who have worked tirelessly for the last 30 years. And I feel like sometimes we give them short shrift and we say, oh, nothing's happened until 5 years ago. But really, I mean, a lot of groundwork was laid and it's paying off now. So understanding hemoglobin, understanding how sickle cell works, understanding adhesion has led to basic science breakthroughs that have generated new drugs. And we got two drugs approved just this last November, which were the first or the third and fourth drug in the last 20 years. And they're neither of them are cures. They're not perfect drugs, but just to have something that can make a difference is exciting. And then, you know, we go to meetings and there's so many things going on. There's so much excitement. There's so much pharma interest. There's so many different approaches, including things that could be cures, like gene therapy. There's, you know, maybe five different companies working on gene therapy. They were all reporting 2-3 patients at ASH. A lot of it looked really promising. So I think we're really on the cusp of big advances, and boy, do people with sickle cell need it. So it's
needed. But do you feel that they share your excitement? We were just a little while ago speaking with a person with sickle cell for another podcast that we're all working on, and I kind of got from him that he doesn't share the excitement that I sense from you both, and that I understand. What do you find? Are patients excited or not?
So I guess it's that's a complicated question. We haven't, as a medical system in this country, we historically have not given the African American community a lot to be excited about. And I think that there's optimism, but I think it's measured optimism. I think that it's cautious, because, you know, we have some bridges that we need to rebuild. And I think that's happening. But I think there's still rightful sort of scrutiny with messages we deliver. And I think that while that's getting better, I think it exists. So even when, you know, we talked about this in another podcast, I looked at sort of the sentiment around new developments in sickle cell disease on Twitter. And if you remember, the physicians were most positive, and the patients had the lowest positive sentiment there.
Yeah.
And I think that that's telling of what we're sort of seeing in real life, too.
Yeah, and I think it's a couple of things. I think one is, you know, that's the reason for this podcast. I think a lot of things don't make their way to the patients as well as they should. So, you know, I think when I talk to patients one-on-one in clinic and I tell them about all these things, they do seem excited. They are enthusiastic about it. So I think some of it is that just hasn't made its way there. And I hope things like this, because one patient at a time in clinic, we can't get to everybody, but hopefully people can tune in and hear about updates here. But I think, too, we've got to deliver the goods. So, you know, there's reason for optimism now. But until people start feeling better, I share their skepticism. Sure. I think it's reasonable.
Dr. Z kind of spoke to this, but Dr. Callahan, knowing that you also have background in hemophilia and are active in hemophilia, with our listenership being a big hemophilia VWD contingency, can you kind of describe the communities in relation to one another for the benefit of a heme VWD audience?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I grew up in hemophilia and bleeding disorders, and that was my first love. I had a wonderful mentor at Children's Hospital called Gene Lusher. And I spent time in a guy called Randy Kaufman's lab. Randy cloned factor 8 and started a company that made one of the first recombinant products, and continues to study factor 8. I from early in residency and until now, I've been involved in camp and with the hemophilia chapter. It's a wonderful community. And I came in at, you know, an interesting time. It was by the time I was getting into hemophilia, HIV was, you know, starting to be in the rearview mirror.
Mm-hmm.
There were effective treatments. The products that we were using to treat hemophilia were no longer causing infections. But I think there was still a lot of angst and fear around that. And I've seen that, you know, subside over time.
It's kind of interesting, and sorry to cut you off, but just strikes me. I heard earlier in one of the interviews we were doing, either 92, 93, 94 being brought up is when there was a medication for sickle cell last made available prior to this past November. And if we think about the early 90s with recombinant and all the developments that hemophilia has seen since and all the new products that hemophilia has seen since, and with sickle cell, it wasn't until this past November.
Right. So, I mean, this has been a sort of stark divide for me, because I still... work in the hemophilia treatment center, and I'm very involved in hemophilia and do clinical trials. And, you know, I walk from one side of the hall where I have a great hemophilia team and lots of resources and a really tight-knit community, to the other side of the hall where I have great people, but just a lot of unmet need, a lot more patients, and not as many resources. And resources in all sorts of ways. I mean, I have fewer nurses and less. We're fortunate, or one of the few places in the country with, you know, a really strong, longstanding patient organization. The Sickle Cell Disease Association of Michigan chapter has been a leader for decades and is great to work with. But on the hemophilia side, there's so many strong organizations, meetings, events. It really brings the community together. I know a lot of guys with hemophilia who are, you know, in their 30s or 40s, and they have friends going from camp decades mm-hmm. back. They stand up in each other's weddings. I mean, it's really a tight-knit community.
Do you see that starting in sickle cell with what's happening?
I do. I mean, we have a camp now. I think the kids are getting together more, and I think the therapy is getting better too. So, you know, 40 years ago, people with sickle cell were dying of infections, and they weren't living to 20, and even the people who were living were having a lot of complications. And I'd like to say that's all over, but still a lot of difficulty for people living with sickle cell. But it's getting better. We've got a lot of adults now with sickle cell, and I think there are more opportunities to get together, to build community, to advocate, and that's great to see. And I feel like we're in the early days of this, and that, it's exciting to be a part of that.
So Cheat Codes, a sickle cell podcast from Bloodstream Media, is also available. You should subscribe to that. You could probably do it now while you're listening to this. We'll even give you a second. Okay, so you probably subscribed. What have you found to be the early response from the podcast? I know the first three episodes came out just before ASH, major conference in hematology and in sickle cell specifically. What have you found to be the early response to Cheat Codes?
It's been overwhelmingly positive from people in industry, from patients, from colleagues. People have been very, very happy with our content and have been very supportive. It's been wonderful.
I agree. I mean, we really appreciate working with you, because when we tape these things, we actually sound really dumb and there's lots of pauses. You put it together and make it sound like a professional operation. But
it's me that makes this thing sound smart, the Sickle Cell Podcast, sure. But thank you.
There's been a lot of good feedback. And I love it when I hear from somebody who I don't know how they possibly could have heard of this. And then I get a text and I say, I heard your podcast and, you know, this was really funny. And it's great that it's, you know, getting out there and people are listening.
It's true. It's rewarding and also a good accountability reminder. Whenever I find people come up to me, same thing. I love the podcast. I'm like, how did you find out about it? But it's a reminder that once it's out there for everybody. So we better make them good. I want to talk a little more about sickle cell with regard to pain, because one of the things that we're working on for later this spring is a podcast about pain called The Pain Pod. And I've had chronic pain as a person with hemophilia from a young age. I know a lot of people with chronic pain. It seems like most people have some form of chronic pain, but pain in sickle cell deserves its own few minutes of conversation. What role does pain play in the life of someone with sickle cell?
Yeah, so I would say, you know, probably more than anything, pain is the sine qua non of sickle cell. I mean, I think if people think of sickle cell, they think of pain episodes. And it's a different kind of pain. I mean, I never had a sickle cell pain episode, thank God, but it's bone-crushing pain. I mean, it's blood is not getting to your tissue, and it's dying kind of pain. And you know, we have patients who you can see that on their face. They're sweating, they're writhing. It's an awful thing to see. We have other patients who, you know, they're very stoic. You don't see that, but it affects their lives tremendously. And I think I mentioned earlier, there's about 200,000 pain episode ED visits in the United States per year. That's two per patient per year. And that's just the ones that bring you to the ED. There's a lot of pain that happens at home that's managed at home. And, you know, dealing with chronic pain is miserable. I think if you have pain, it's what's on your mind right now. It's the most, the biggest focus of right now. And it's hard to do other things and live when you're in pain. Mm-hmm. So when you have sickle cell and you have pain, or you have the fear that it could happen anytime, you know, it's horribly detrimental to your life. And we've had a lot of problems recently, and always, but recently especially, getting people appropriate pain management. I think we've never done a good job of thinking about all of the psychosocial aspects of it, all of the ways you can support people, all of the non-traditional methods to address pain. But we have used narcotics for pain, and they can be effective. And we've done that for many years in sickle cell without overdoses, without a whole lot of abuse or diversion. And so I understand there's an opioid crisis and people are misusing pain medications and people are dying from overdoses. But that's not sickle cell. That's not our patients. And the response to that is hurting our patients. It's making it harder to get pain medicines for people when they go to some other sources, not us, but other doctors. They're very reticent to give them any pain medication, or they give them just a very little bit. Even ourselves, we're only allowed to give certain durations of pain medication. We have to file paperwork about all of this and track it. And sometimes that means that people run out of pain medicine. They don't have transportation. They're in pain. They're at home. They have to come to the hospital to get a prescription. It's very inconvenient.
Now they're missing work or school, and that they're set back in that way. It's hurting them financially, and we're starting the downward spiral. Yeah.
I think, just to add a layer to that, the biologic pain is obviously real and bone crushing, like Dr. Callahan mentioned. But there's this extra layer on that, and it's a different type of psychosocial pain, right? That is largely because this is happening. You have to remember there's lots of chronic pain conditions, but very few that isolate themselves so predominantly by race. That extra psychosocial layer and the pain of not being believed that you're in pain, and the pain of having to put on a show to be treated appropriately for your pain, I think that really contributes to the entire sort of just the whole the broader picture of pain. I think that, you know, the PTSD you have with every bad subsequent visit, where there's some arrogant physician who doesn't believe you, someone telling you your labs are normal so you can't be in pain, which I think is very unique to sort of sickle cell disease. I think that really contributes to why patients feel like they're so alone in this particular pain state.
I don't want to get you too hot, but we were talking earlier about the New York Times article and some of the language in there that I think this reminds me of. Can you give listeners a little insight into that?
Yeah, so, you know, of course, anytime new drugs come out, price points start getting discussed and become a very hot topic. The New York Times basically had an article come out shortly after the approval of both of these new drugs, Adakveo and Oxbryta, essentially saying that these drugs help but cost a lot, and who's going to pay for them. And the entire tone of that sort of article was that there's already a medication for sickle cell disease that's pretty cheap. Only a quarter of the patients are taking that medication. We should probably make sure that they try the cheap option before we say that we're going to pay for the expensive one.
Especially because they have some kind of brain damage as a result of sickle cell. What?
So they mentioned that patients with sickle cell disease may have subtle or overt brain damage that can inhibit their ability to stick to treatment plans or understand treatment.
That's just crazy. I can't like pretend. That's just crazy.
It's unbelievable, right? It's just the way we scrutinize patients with sickle cell disease is unlike any other disease state. And it's a commentary on our society, actually, at large. And that's painful to providers, patients, society at large. So it hurts at a different level.
What are the ways to attack that? How in this era where there is such a shift and maybe a momentum to kind of capitalize on, how does that narrative start to change? How does the writing in the New York Times and publications start to change about sickle cell?
I think that everything starts with conversation. And I think that the more people that you just talk to about sickle cell disease, I mean, if you give me a 10-second window, I'll fit in a conversation about sickle cell disease with anybody. I think that we just have to have those conversations more frequently. And I think that we have to be willing, I don't know if I can say bullshit on your podcast, but
go for it.
I'm going to say it. I think we have to be willing to call people out on their bullshit. So I even tell the trainees this, you know, the residents and the med students, if there's an attending who's being biased, racist, prejudiced, is saying things that are untrue, call them out on it. Find somebody, tell them that this is happening, because that's the only way to make it stop. Is no, what you're saying is wrong. You know, there are sickle cell disease patients out there that don't have brain damage and who know more about sickle cell disease than some of the doctors. So I think that as we have more conversations, I think knowledge is always the only way to make things better. And what I try to do personally now, and Dr. Callahan, is empower patients with knowledge of their own disease. So if you want patients to be treated better, I think arming them with the ability to have these really open, intelligent conversations with providers is going to be key.
Do you ever worry, though, as a doctor, how outspoken you are? I mean, you are such an advocate, and I think you are a vital type of doctor to have, being so outspoken. But I also sometimes see your tweets and see what you put out there and wonder, does he ever worry that this is going to come back to hurt him?
Yes and no, I guess. I mean, I think that if you have a cause that is worth speaking up about and you feel strongly enough about it, you know, the reason that I do this in the first place is because there was a point where I was like, I don't even know if I want to be a doctor anymore. This job kind of sucks, right? And I got to a point where I finally found something that makes me get out of bed. Right. I want to get to work and do this. I want to fight this. I want to be part of this movement.
Yeah.
And that excites me. Right. And that made me want to stay in medicine. Otherwise, I was ready to check out. So if it does come back and bites me and I can't be a doctor, guess what? I'll still be an advocate. Right. And that's OK. And I'm totally good with that timeline.
Yeah. Yeah. Very cool. Dr. Callahan, can you tell me a little bit about your hopes for, say, just the next 5 years in sickle cell and in hemophilia, since we're here?
Yeah, no, for both sickle cell and hemophilia, I'm really optimistic about the next 5 years. I think we got a huge opportunity on both fronts. I think on the sickle cell side, we have these new tools, and I think they are going to make things better. We need to find ways to get the right drug into the right patient at the right time, and also to surround that with the right care, the right social supports. And really, I think there's an opportunity to make care better all around. There's also some really exciting things going on around gene therapy. It's, I think, not quite there yet, but it's getting there. So I think our goal for the next 5 years is to keep people healthy enough that when that cure comes, because I think it really is coming, they're in good shape, they can get that cure and still be able to maintain a great life. On the hemophilia side, I'm also really optimistic. I think it's changed so much since I joined, which wasn't that long ago. I think we went from recombinant products that were great, they were safe, they work, they treat bleeds, they prevent bleeds. We got extended half-life products that, you know, make things maybe a little bit more convenient. Now we're starting to have non-factor therapies, which I think are huge changes. You have, you know, steady, pretty high protection. It maybe allows you to stop thinking about hemophilia sometimes and just live and not have such a high treatment burden. And we have gene therapy. I hope that takes off and really we can cure people. I think, you know, that's all great. We still have a lot of work to do. I think, yeah. You know, there's a lot of bad joints out there. I have some guys who are on study and they said, great, you know, I'm not bleeding anymore. What are you going to do about my knees now? What are you going to do about my ankles now?
Right? Like, we don't know that either, because we are seeing a population age in a way we haven't had before. So we're going to have to learn what that means too.
Absolutely. So I you know, I'm optimistic about all this. I think we've got so much work to do.
Yeah.
To figure out how to do this right and make sure everybody's getting the plan that's right for them and allows them to live their best life.
Well, I should let you get back to that work. I will say again, thank you so much for the time on this. It's been such a pleasure to work with you on Cheat Codes, a sickle cell podcast, which you should go and subscribe to. Just listen to an episode, even if you are not a member of the sickle cell community. You've heard these two gentlemen. They're very smart. They're entertaining to listen to. And we try to put a nice podcast together for you. So Cheat Codes, a sickle cell podcast. I also want to recommend Dr. Z can be seen in a TEDx from TEDx Detroit toward the end of last year. It's on YouTube. So if you look up sickle cell TEDx, Dr. Zadie, you'll be able to find it. So again, Dr. Callahan, Dr. Zadie, thanks for agreeing to do this.
Thanks
for having us.
Hey, Bloodstream listeners, it's producer Greg here. After that interview with Patrick and Dr. Mike and Dr. Zadie, I wanted to play a quick snippet from episode 3 of Cheat Codes with the doctors talking about potential uses of THC and CBD in sickle cell treatment. Enjoy, and be sure to subscribe to Cheat Codes to hear the rest of the episode and the many more to come.
There's maybe two pieces to that cannabis. You know, one is yes or no, and the other is if yes, how? And smoking is probably not the answer.
Right. So I think that's a key point that I think that really needs to be emphasized over and over again, is that if you believe in cannabis being a major player in your therapy, certainly smoking it is the wrong choice, especially knowing that lung issues are a major cause of death in patients with sickle cell disease. Coming to the positive side here a little bit, I do think that there's probably a role for THC, CBD in multiple settings in sickle cell disease.
One last time, I want to thank our presenting sponsor, Takeda, without whom we could not make the Bloodstream podcast. Visit bleedingdisorders.com to learn more about the resources Takeda provides to the bleeding disorders community. And hey, thanks, Takeda. Bloodstream flagship for February is in the books, Natalie. That's about all. Are you ready to say goodbye?
I mean, never. I love doing this.
Oh, thanks. I love doing this too.
Oh.
Should we just keep going?
No, but I mean, the listeners probably want to listen to like their other podcasts now.
Like Bloodstream Journeys probably, yeah. And Ask the Expert in Cheat Codes, a
exactly,
sickle cell podcast. Good
exactly.
Point. We better wrap this up. Yeah. That is all for this episode. Thank you to everyone at Believe Limited, Bloodstream Media, NHFE2AC, HFA, the Hemophilia Alliance, Doctors Mike and Amar from Cheat Codes, the Sickle Cell Podcast, our presenting sponsor Takeda, as well as our like sponsor Genentech. Please, for the love of Swedish fish, subscribe to the Bloodstream Podcast, the Ask the Expert Podcast, Bloodstream Journeys and Cheat Codes, the Sickle Cell Podcast on Apple, SoundCloud, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Leave us ratings, share our shows, and help us spread the word. You can email us mailbag@bloodstreammedia.com, find Bloodstream on facebook.com/bloodstreammedia, and on Twitter @bloodstreaminfo. Same on Instagram. Reminder to check out the program notes for this episode in your podcast player for links and additional information about the various stories featured on this episode. My name remains Patrick James Lynch.
And I'm Natalie Lynch.
And until next time, take self-care of yourself. Bye, everybody.